Hello, and thanks for listening to the Jambase Podcast, a proud member of the OSIRIS Podcast Network. I'm Scott Bernstein, and on this episode, you'll hear my The Art of the Setlist chat with Holly Bowling. Before the interview, we'll start with the rundown of recent news stories. And today, I'm joined by Jambase contributing writer, Chad Bernson. How's it going, Chad?
Always great to be here, Scotty. Thanks.
Excellent. Glad to have you. And one of the biggest stories of late is the announcement Oysterhead is reuniting. The supergroup features Phish guitarist Trey Anastasio, Primus bassist Les Claypool, and the Police drummer Stuart Copeland. Oysterhead initially formed for a late night gig during Jazz Fest in 2000, and the members of the band went on to record and release their lone studio album the following year. The trio hit the road in 2001 to support that album, The Grand Pecking Order, and reunited in 2006 to play Bonnaroo. As of now, there's just two shows on the books, as the first Oysterhead performances in nearly 13 years will take place at the First Bank Center in Broomfield, Colorado on February 14th and 15th. There's so many questions in my mind regarding the return of Oysterhead. What else do they have planned? Will they record a new album? What songs will they play? And of course, how will they sound? So much has changed for these guys on both personal and professional levels since they last toured 18 years ago. Well, we'll certainly find out soon enough. What else is going on, Chad?
Well, my mind is blown that it's been that long.
I know. Can
and
you believe
I have
it?
Many of the same questions you do. What is this going to sound like? But we'll find out.
Yeah, I can't
wait.
We'll find
out soon enough.
I can't wait.
Scotty, unfortunately, Phil Lesh's recovery from back surgery isn't progressing as quickly as hoped. Phil's annual Philoween run at the Capitol Theater in Port Chester, New York, always hotly anticipated, especially in the area, has been unfortunately postponed. The announcement came after the Grateful Dead bassist previously canceled all of his September dates due to what was described as minor back surgery. Quote, Phil's surgery was a success, and we are working with Phil to reschedule the shows and will announce new dates as soon as we can. We're reading from part of the announcement made by the Cap earlier this week. The announcement was accompanied by a video featuring Lesh, and Phil told his fans he's feeling really good, but the doctors recommend he takes more time to recover from the surgery that he recently had. All of us, of course, at Team Jambase wish Phil the very best in his ongoing recovery. The Phil Lesh and Friends dates that were supposed to take place October 31st through November 2nd are now being filled by Dark Star Orchestra, and DSO has announced that they will play set lists from past Grateful Dead shows at the venue. So definitely still a good reason to get your dead on over Halloween timeframe. Scotty, you recently had a chance to see a Live From Here broadcast at Town Hall here in New York City. Hey man, how was it?
I'm still on cloud nine. I mean, the last time that you were on the podcast, you mentioned how incredible of a job Chris Thiele does hosting the show and how they get such a diverse and interesting batch of guests. Well, Chad, you are most certainly right on both accounts. I was blown away by the experience from the first note of the warm-ups to the last of the bonus song that wasn't aired. And talk about a diverse group of guests. The episode featured Trey Anastasio, the Jazz at Lincoln Center Orchestra with Wynton Marsalis, Sarah Jarosz, as well as comedians Dulce Sloan and Tom Papa. I was particularly struck by how well Chris and his team keep the action on schedule while still infusing so much spontaneity into the episode. I mean, Thiele is such a talented musician who has the personality to match. And one of the highlights of the episode was a performance of an original he wrote, according to him at least, the previous night, entitled CQ. I was mesmerized listening to Chris explain the genesis of the song. And a tune like CQ features elements of so many genres over the course of 5 minutes. And that's just one song he wrote for one episode of the show. And of course, getting to see Trey play with other musicians he respects that he doesn't get to play with often is always a treat. I really like the song choices, as Anastasio joined Chris, Sarah, and the Live From Here house band for renditions of Phish classics Theme From the Bottom and If I Could, as well as the Ghost of the Forest tune A Life Beyond the Dream, and a cover of Chuck Berry's Born in the USA, and that came during the show's recurring Musician's Birthday segment. Phish's Hoist was the first Phish album that came out after I started listening to the band, and I always loved what Alison Krauss brought to If I Could. Sarah Jarosz sang the part Alison handled in the studio and duetted with Trey, and I just get goosebumps thinking about it. Jerose put so much emotion into each lyric. 'Twas a beautiful thing. Plus, fiddler Brittany Haas added a gorgeous melody during Trey's solo that nearly brought a tear to my eye. Before that was Theme from the Bottom, and it was fantastic to hear the spot-on harmonies that you, to be honest, you don't get often at Fish shows. I've also become more of a fan of Life Beyond the Dream as the months pass by and see why Trey likes the song so much. Gotta give credit to Dulce Sloan, who followed Life Beyond the Dream by telling the crowd, "I can't believe I'm about to do stand-up after the chillest song I've ever heard." I mean, myself and many of those around me were in hysterics at that line, and she had us cracking up the whole time that she was on stage. I was belly laughing throughout her whole set. I mean, I really, kudos to her for following A Life Beyond the Dream with a hilarious stand-up set. Another cool moment came when Ed Norton came out to read a passage from Motherless Brooklyn, a book he used as the basis for a movie of the same name that he wrote, produced, and directed. Ed told the crowd he convinced Radiohead's Thom Yorke to write a song for the film and got Wynton Marsalis to adapt the tune as if it was played by Miles Davis for the movie. With that, enter the Jazz at Lincoln Center Orchestra, who played a wild version of the tune, which is called Daily Battles. All the videos are up on the Live From Here YouTube channel, and we've certainly posted about it on Jambase. I highly recommend checking it out. And, you know, as far as the orchestra, they're among the best in the business. And the capper to the whole evening came when Trey joined the jazz ensemble for a version of Fish's Blaze On like no other. The sheer joy on the faces of the musicians all night was really a sight to behold. And I imagine that's what I looked like as well. And speaking of making a joyful noise, Chad and I had the chance to watch the Tedeschi Trucks Band close out this year's Beacon Theater residency. Chad wrote a fantastic review that won raves from a number of people I talked to. Why don't you share some of your thoughts on that October 5th show with our listeners?
Oh, I'm glad to. And what an October so far. And there's since so much more to go. Well, thank you for that, Scotty. And kudos, of course, to the Tedeschi Trucks Band themselves on their ninth Beacon Theater residency. This one's definitely a tradition by now. 9 years in, I think we can say it's tradition. You know, I titled my review in part, you know, the brutality of all-timer expectations. And the title's kind of loaded for a reason. Tedeschi Trucks Band, they feel like an all-timer. I mean, you've got this powerhouse of musicians on stage who can handle all this different music and not just make it sound like a jukebox or a band in good command of a number of different styles, but make a really coherent show out of it, and one that gets insanely good and super emotional based on how powerful the music they're delivering really can be. You know, in front of it, you've got Susan Tedeschi herself, who even despite all of her accolades, still feels almost underrated as one of the great singers of our time. And then what more can we say about Derek Trucks at this point? Even hardcore Derek heads listen to him go deep in a solo, you know, do all the things he does to turn up new ideas, try stuff. And when he does that long build, I'm geeking hard here, but when he does that long build and gets to that really shattering climax, you really do feel like you've heard it fresh again in many ways. And just an extraordinary 1% of the 1% all-time exactly. Guitar player. And, you know, I think what I love about Tedeschi Trucks Band overall, Scotty, is that it marries, you know, well, obviously Derek and Susan, who are married, but it marries, well, you know, what was terrific about their past solo bands and keeps a ton of heart and soul in that. I think in the hands of lesser musicians would be interesting, but not as deep as I think they can go.
Well, as you said, though, the expectations of being an all-timer can be brutal.
Absolutely. I mean, take this last show of the run. You had just these massive, massive moments in Shame and Midnight in Harlem, which, you know, are two of the band's strongest originals. And also, you know, in their version the same night of the Allman Brothers Band's Dreams, which they started covering earlier this year in 2019, and Bob Dylan's Don't Think Twice, It's All Right, which, you know, of course, Susan has been singing for decades in various capacities. And, you know, any show is going to have its highlights, but these moments, for me anyway, were so potent and rich, and they made a lot of other moments of the show seem a little thin by comparison. And I mean, you know, not every show can be A+ every time. We all know that as concert lovers. And the more we see, the higher our standards get. But Tedeschi Trucks Band, they always make you feel like every show could be an A+. Just based on the caliber of folks we're doing with. And I mean, that's the brutality of all-timer expectations, my friend.
Indeed. And I would say going into it, I was most excited for guest spots and covers. But it was particularly cool to me that Shame and Midnight in Harlem, two originals, were really the standout moments of the night. And I think we were both looking at, we went to the shows together, and we were both looking at each other during both of Derek's solos. And it's just like Chad described, he put so much emotion into it and built up to such a great head. And I like that they brought up Joss Stone as a special guest. I thought she meshed well with Susan. It was nice that it wasn't your typical jam scene collaborator. But regardless, as we talked about earlier, I'm really glad that the residency has become a tradition and we can count on it happening each year, because I really miss the March Madness Allman Brothers runs.
Me too. And I to think that it's now been 10 years since the legendary 2009 Allman Brothers Band run, arguably, you know, the peak of this last version of the Allman Brothers, and in terms of the March residency, time marches on, man.
It's very true, and I'm glad there's people still marching. Well, that's it for the rundown. We'll get to my chat with Holly soon. But first, this episode is sponsored by Eagle Rock Entertainment, who will release the Magpie Salutes Highwater 2 on Friday, October 18th. The band, which features Black Crowes alums Rich Robinson, Mark Ford, Sven Pippen, along with John Hogg, Joe Magistro, and Matt Slocum, recorded the 12-track album at the same time as their 2018 album, Highwater 1. Both were recorded at Dark Horse Studios in Nashville. Quote, "We're all really happy to put out the second half of Highwater," unquote, Rich Robinson said in a statement. I quote again, "Since its inception, I always viewed it as a single piece. Highwater 2 will tie together both albums into a whole journey." As a preview of the album, here's Doesn't Really Matter from the Magpie Salutes Highwater 2.
So good that you have to see. So what you gonna do?
Hello, and welcome back to the Jambase Podcast. My name is Scott Bernstein, and I'm in our New York City headquarters with Holly Bowling. Welcome back to the podcast, Holly.
Thanks for having me back.
The last time we spoke was when you were on Jam Cruise 17. It was early 2018, and at the time you had started Ghostlight, but I actually hadn't played live yet, and I spoke with you and Tommy at the time. And can you tell us a little bit about how the past year and 6 months or so has gone for Ghostlight?
It's been incredible. That band, our first year and a half now, has been pretty fast and furious. We just hit our 100th show a couple shows back over the summer.
Wow.
And it's been really fun to dive in that intensely from the get-go. I feel like the band has changed and progressed and really learned how to read each other in different ways and in better and better ways pretty quickly, just because we hit the road pretty hard initially. And it's such a fun band.
that's incredible. And has the repertoire changed much since the first few shows? Have you added songs besides the ones that you recorded for the album?
There's some songs that we have in our rotation that are originals, Ghostlight originals, that didn't make the album. There's some that are in the rotation that weren't there in our initial shows. It's definitely been growing. We've also switched up the covers, and we've dipped into some of Tom's back catalog of stuff that he's written in years past, and you know, made those into Ghostlight songs and let them grow and evolve into something new. So it's been slowly growing and turning into, you know, an ever-evolving, shape-shifting body of songs to choose from each night.
Oh, that's great. And this is the art of the set list. So we'll be diving into how Ghostlight goes about putting together their set list. But first, right now, Holly, you're in the middle of a solo piano tour. And last night, you played a show in New York City at Le Poisson Rouge. And
yeah.
I was busy looking for puppies, but how did the show go last night?
The show was incredible. I love that room, and I love their piano, and it was a great crowd. New York City is always just a ton of fun to play for. And I also got to say, for your part, that's the best excuse you could ever give me for missing a show. I would have been there, but puppies. I'm like, you know what? I would have made the same choice if I had had the option.
Absolutely, and hopefully it's going to lead to a beautiful new lab puppy in my life. So that's great. And in terms of, let's use the example of last night. How did you go about putting together the set list for last night's show?
So for my solo stuff, there's a lot that goes into it. I mean, for one thing, this goes without saying in this scene, but I try to change it up a lot night to night. I do a lot more planning in my solo stuff as far as what I want to play that night and the arc of the show that I'm trying to shape. Part of the deal there is, you know, when you're in a band with four or five people on stage, everyone's tossing out ideas, and sometimes there's space to sit back and, you know, lay out for eight bars and kind of think about what you want to happen next. When it's just me and a piano up there, there's not a whole lot of time to go on autopilot or just, you know, take 16 bars of space.
Sure.
So I like to have a pretty clear game plan going in. That said, there's plenty of adjustment that happens on the fly too. There's a lot of improvising in what I do, and sometimes things go much longer than intended in a very good way. And I'm never one to, you know, chop off what's happening musically.
Sure.
in the interest of, well, I decided I'm going to play this, so let's let's stick to the map.
Right.
But there's, you know, there's particular songs that I've really grown to love as openers and closers, kind of things that set the scene and open up the pages of the book, and then, you know, things that really have a momentum and a finality that everything else can build to. So, you know, for example, the live album that I just put out a couple weeks ago, let's see, it was a two-night run, and so I think I did Help on the Way in the first night, and then closed out the second night with Franklin's Tower.
Very cool.
Right? Yeah, so that's kind of like, you know, the thing's been opened, the storyline is out there floating around, and I'm kind of waiting to weave it all back in and, you know, bring all the strands of the musical ideas back together again.
Thank you. I would imagine that that gives you the, you need to finish with Franklin, so that's not getting cut. So
yeah, so then there's like a little dance of like what to move around in between or what to leave out or what to extend. But another thing I really love doing with this, you know, it's this body of work, a huge repertoire of songs between Fish and the Dead. There's just an infinite pool of ideas to pull from.
Sure.
And once I have a few things out there, it's kind of like having several balls being juggled in the air, right? And you're just waiting for all of them to eventually fall. But while they're up there, you can pull little strands from each of these different songs and weave the motives or melodies together and, you know, tease them here or like sneak them in a way that's reharmonized in a new key that's like, was that what that was? Or was, did I hear that? Or was it there? You know? And so I'm trying to kind of have all these things always floating around the ether that eventually then come back together in a way that is powerful.
Are these medleys slash mashups pre-planned or is it just improvised?
That stuff's all improvised.
Okay.
So the idea of like, these are some of the big songs I think I want to play tonight. And I have an idea that like, this one's going to feel good in this part of the show. And this one I'd like to open the second set with, whatever. That kind of stuff I'll plan out. Medleys and teases and figuring out, you know, maybe this song would sound cool mashed up with this one. That stuff is all on the fly. And half the time it kind of happens unintentionally, and once it's come out of my fingers once and I'm like, oh, that was cool, we should let's build on that, you know.
And speaking of that, about a week ago you played a show where you did Mike's Hydrogen Week upon put plenty of songs in between it, and it almost lasted the whole set, the Mike's Week upon with the other one in there and some other songs. Was that planned? Do you recall what I'm talking about yet?
Yeah, absolutely. So I just started doing that suite of songs, or I guess that's what you'd call it, on this tour. And that's an interesting one. It's, you know, one of the things with my catalog of songs that I play solo is that when I first started doing it, I picked all this stuff that was in some ways easiest to translate for piano, or that, you know, made the leap most naturally for me. And now that I've kind of, you know, skimmed all that stuff off the top and I've done it and played it a lot, I'm digging deeper into the repertoire, which means that there's, you know, hidden gems to discover. And there's also stuff that I tried before and then set down because it didn't immediately translate to piano for me. And so coming back to some of that stuff later, with, you know, more years of playing this music in a solo piano context under my belt, and also just a renewed determination that like, well, I don't have, you know, I don't have a lot of easier things to pick from at this point. So I'm going to have to dig in and figure out like new techniques or new approaches. So Mike's Hydrogen Weekapog was one of those for me. Hydrogen translated really easily, and figuring out how to pull off something like Weekapog that's so focused on the bass and also just this constant driving percussion was really a challenge. So one of the things that's cool about being able to split the stuff up like that is that, you know, you kind of know it's coming, you know it's off there in the distance, it's going to get finished, but it gives me a lot more room to breathe and space to branch out into other areas, because, you know, it's not possible for me to replicate what Fish does with those songs.
Sure.
Nor is that my aim, you know?
Oh, right.
So to be able to have the freedom to split it off into other songs and go off into other harmonic territory and other, you know, rhythmic feels and textures, I think helps break up what can, if you're not careful, become monotony when it's something that's on a single instrument.
Of course.
So.
That's very cool, and we'll have a link to that show for those who want to listen to how it went down. And earlier you spoke about a new live album that you put out. It was recorded in Portland, Oregon, and why that show?
That show was not intended to be a live release in any way, shape, or form. It was just one of those nights where everything clicked and everything flowed, and I just had so much fun playing. I just remember walking off the stage, and you know, I can be relentlessly self-critical, and I'll often come off stage and be like, that was cool, but,
okay,
you know, and have a lot of things that I would have done differently, you know, which is fine. That's a constant battle for a lot of people, I think. But this was one of those nights where I walked off stage and was just like, I felt really good about that. I want to keep playing. I could play for another 5 hours right now, you know, when you lock into that state that just, you know, you're out of the way and there's just music happening the
right
way it should be. And so, you know, we sat with the recording for a while, and then the idea of doing a live album started to percolate, and it was a pretty easy choice to be like, well, that's that's the show we should do. So, and we didn't edit or chop it up as far as like fixing any of the imperfections that are in there, which is something that I love. It's not a compilation. It's not a best of. It's just like a very straightforward, honest, like, this is what it was. Here it is. We spent, you know, a lot of time getting the audio quality as pristine as we could. But as far as the playing itself, I wanted to just put it out there as this is, you know, this is what came out that night. And there's flaws, but the emotion and the intent behind it, I feel really strongly about and I'm proud of. So
that's great. And that's
really
a good
stoked on it.
Representation of a moment in time. And to go back and add things or take away things, it isn't quite that same representation of a moment in time.
Yeah, exactly. And I just feel like there's so much stuff in every facet of the world that we live in today that's like processed or touched up or made artificially perfect in it. It's just this like false, unrealistic, like weird thing that we're living in. And so like that's one of the things that appeals to me about improvisational music in general. It's just like there is this acceptance of risk and acceptance of the occasional mistake and flaw and the fact that, you know, you take a leap. Sometimes it's going to be a leap of glory and sometimes it's going to end really, really badly in disaster. And everyone's fine with that, you know, that vulnerability and that potential for failure. And that's something that really appeals to me. And I wanted to preserve that in the album rather than taking like, you know, here's the highlights reel from last tour.
No, that's a great call. This tour you added About to Run, which Trey played as part of his Ghost of the Forest project, and then Fish started playing it as well. How did you decide on that song to bring to your repertoire?
I wanted to bring in some new Fish stuff, and I didn't want to always be dipping into the, you know, the much older stuff. I like to try to pull from a lot of different eras. But that song in particular, it just, it appealed to me from the get-go when I heard it. It's dark, it's haunting. It just has a sound to it that really appealed to me. I love dark Fish, evil Fish, all that stuff. And this one isn't evil. It's, you know, it's sad and haunting and dark and beautiful. And it goes into a register of the piano that I feel like replicates that really well to the lower end. And I did a bunch of stuff with it where I wouldn't say palm muting because I'm using just my fingertips, but I have the fingertips of my left hand covering three of the lowest strings on the piano. And then I'm playing those notes on the keyboard with my right hand. And so you get the attack of the note, and then you also have this sort of ghost of the note that is just like a halo of sound around it that just floats there and stays. And it perfectly captured, in my mind at least, you know, the hauntingness of the song and the lyrics and the whole thing behind it and behind, you know, that whole band and project. It's, you know, combination of factors, liking the song and then also liking how it translated to the piano and feeling like the way I could do it on piano was going to bring an interesting angle to the song. It's like another part of the selection. I don't want to do a song just to do it. Like, I have to be able to do something interesting to it.
Sure.
Or put a certain aspect of the song into the light in a way that that wouldn't have been the most apparent thing before. So that's always kind of a concern or a thought in my mind.
Or motivation.
Yeah.
And how, this is the art of the set list, how has it gone working that song into your set list? Where does it fit?
Well, that's going to be an evolving question.
Okay.
But at this point, it's been a good transition song for me. And by transition, I mean, there's these very different energies and harmonies and stuff that are in you know, some of the more emotional dead songs versus some of the really like high energy or proggy or dissonant Fish songs. You know, like you have something like Broke Down Palace and then you have It's Ice.
Yeah.
It's like those two do not go next to each other, you know? No. So one of the challenges for me constantly when I'm designing a set list, or just playing, is how to get from like emotional space A to emotional space B. And that space in between is part of what I think gives an arc to my improvisation at times, because I'm trying to move back and forth between the catalog of the two bands, and they occupy very different emotional spaces sure. often. So About to Run is cool because I feel like it bridges that gap. So if I play something that's very emotional and, you know, Stella or Broke Down or anything like that, and then I want to bring back some energy but not punch everyone in the face with it right away, that's a good one that can start out quiet but dark, and then it just expands into this super driving, you know, energetic thing. And then that lets me get to the next point I want to be at. So
a palate cleanser, almost like a sorbet for chefs.
I mean, I wouldn't call that song a sorbet because it's heavy.
Right,
you know?
That's a good point. Yeah,
it's like, you know, you had a good cry and you have a friend come and put their arm around you, and then you could like go out together back into the world. Yeah, you know?
much know. Better. Well, much better put. Little Martha is a song that has started making your set lists. Is that the first Allman Brothers song that...
Yeah, that's the only one I've done. It's been in rotation for a while. It just doesn't come out very often. Good I work. Actually learned it for my little brother's wedding because he requested that I play that. And then I loved the way it translated to piano. And actually, there's so much interesting guitar lines in their music. I think that a lot of those songs, especially the instrumental ones, would really go well on piano. I just haven't dove into the catalog and, you know, see.
Well, hopefully one day. And another song, Non-Dead Fish, that you played in Ohio was Ohio. Was that the first time that you had played CSNY's on Ohio?
It wasn't, but it's definitely something that comes out rarely. It's such a heavy song.
Yeah, talk about heavy.
You don't want to overdo it. I think I don't remember when the first time I played it was, but it definitely grew out of this feeling of, when that song was written, there was crazy stuff happening and a lot of unrest and a lot of really messed up stuff and feeling like that's where we were at now and wanting to, you know, draw parallels or build a bridge between those things. But playing it this most recent time, I was in Cleveland and it was pretty heavy talking to people afterwards. I knew that, you know, I was close to Kent State, but sure. Someone came up to me afterwards and said that he was actually there.
Oh, wow.
And was like almost shaken, and just, it was a very, a very powerful and direct moment with a total stranger that just was super intense. So it's, you know, some of this music is really, really powerful stuff to be playing with.
Absolutely. Do you take into consideration what you've played the last time you were in a city when you craft a set list?
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. Try not to end up in the same patterns or giving people the same experience.
And how do you keep track of old set lists? Do you just have a note file on your computer, on your phone, or what?
I mean, honestly, all that stuff's online. I'm looking at the same thing everybody else.
Okay, sure.
Or sometimes I'll remember too, especially if there's, you know, songs that were tied to a particular memory in a place or person who was there or event that had happened, and I knew I had played certain stuff. But yeah, I'm constantly trying not to repeat myself in the same locations, and also just trying to push myself not to fall into the same patterns in my set list in general. You know, there's certain things that are always going to work well as a closer, and that's fine, and that's still something that I'm going to do a lot of the time. And then there's times when you have to try putting things in different slots, because if you don't mix it up, you're never going to discover what else might work, you know?
Sure, and evolve.
Yeah, and you just don't want to get too comfortable and fall into the same patterns. So I'm always trying to push myself out of my comfort zone as far as song placement and the arc of the set and where I want there to be high points and low points and space versus manic energy and all those ideas.
To segue into Ghostlight, you recently played the Peach Festival, and at the Peach Festival you did a set with Tom Hamilton.
Yeah.
And for VIPs, and you wound up playing a Ghostlight song, well, using it kind of as the platform for just I think it was about 70 minutes or an hour jam. Was that the plan going into the set, just to play one song?
I mean, our original plan was to not have a plan.
Okay.
We were talking about it. We're like, oh, do we want to do this set? Sure. What do you want to play? Let's just improvise. Great. And that's something that I love about playing with Tom, is that he's always game to do that. And I don't think we've ever had a problem keeping that going for an hour and still keeping it interesting and having new ideas. And so that's always super, super fun for me to have a partner in crime and collaborator who's willing and able to do that. But then for that set, I think a couple minutes before we went on stage, we were like, maybe we should like throw one song in there as a bookend, or as, I kind of think of that stuff as touch points or guideposts along the way, you know, so that you bring people back to something familiar for just a minute, and then you reel the thread out again, you know.
Sure.
And it's kind of like an inhale, exhale, or a, you know, throw the line out and pull it back in. And that constant process is something that I think can give good shape to a really improv heavy hour of music, you know.
And is that something that you felt good about when it was over?
Oh yeah, we had so much fun playing that.
Oh, that's excellent.
Yeah, and just to be able to take freedom with a song that, you know, we've played and do it in a really different context is always fun too, you know.
And so that brings us to Ghostlight. And how is the typical Ghostlight set list put together?
This is cool. This is like totally the opposite of how I do things solo. So we make a song list.
Okay.
Of stuff that we might want to play that night. And we don't often decide what we're going to open with even until we're on stage.
Wow.
Sometimes we'll decide as we're walking on. But it's intentionally undefined. Part of that comes from an idea that if we all know where we're going, then either we can jump the gun or it could limit us on what direction we go. You know, if you're in one key and you know that you need to get to another key, maybe you don't make the left turn that you would have made because you think, well, I already know where this is headed,
okay.
You know? So in a
That's
desire
very cool.
to keep that limiting kind of mindset out of it, it's entirely unscripted. So we just number our song list, and sometimes we'll, you know, communicate that way and let each other know. More often than not at this point, it's just a non-verbal, non-hand signal, you know, musical thing where someone plays a couple notes of something and starts, you know, shifting in that direction, and everyone else decides whether to follow or whether to throw out something else and be like, no, I want to do this. So that's been one cool thing that's changed a lot in the band that I've been really stoked on, is as we get to know each other better as players and musicians, and everyone just becomes really comfortable with the catalog that we're working with, we can be more and more subtle on how we move from one thing to another. I love the mystery of it.
Yeah. And has it always been that way from day one? Has this been your approach to set lists?
I don't think we have ever written a set list.
Wow.
Per se, just a song list. It is funny when people get a set list after the show and they're like, this doesn't look right at all. Yeah. What are they doing? Well, you are correct.
And how does the process of putting the song list together go? Does one person start it, or is it different from night to night?
But it varies a little bit, just depending on, you know, if someone's really busy.
Okay.
Then other people in the band will pick it up. But in general, it's pretty collaborative. Everyone picks a couple songs and throws them on there. If someone doesn't want to play one of them, we take it off. We try not to do the same stuff night to night. And again, that same intention of trying not to play the same set, the same arc, the same show, you know, constantly trying to put things in different places and just, you know, figure out how many different permutations are there here and how many different ways can we do something different with the same elements, you know?
And did it take a lot of rehearsal when you switched bassists to be able to still have that same approach with a different musician in the mix?
That is a great question. Dan is an incredible musician. We were extremely lucky that he was able to step into the gig and run with it. It is a hard gig. Yeah. You know, not only did he have to learn a bunch of songs in short order, which he did amazingly well, but there's also then this thing of, okay, well, we're not going to tell you what we're going to play when. There is no order. Good luck figuring out when we're going to go into something. Also, we like to break them up and play half of that song here, another half here. Maybe we'll fake that we're going into it, but then we'll play the back half of another song. And, you know, if you're coming into an existing band and you have a bunch of brand new to you stuff that you've just learned, playing it in that context is extremely challenging.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
And he just stepped right into the role and did an amazing job. Along those lines, though, I personally feel that as he has been playing with us longer and become just more familiar and comfortable with the repertoire, he's not only been able to pick up on the changes and the transitions and the shifts and be right there, but he's also comfortable enough to start throwing out his own directives that way. So, you know, to hear him making the hint of like, let's do this song next, or let's go to this key, or like, how about we do this, is just so much fun. So having his voice added into that arena has been a really cool evolution since he's been playing with us.
Did it take a little while for him to get to that point?
I guess a little bit, but okay. Much faster than I would have expected, you know, and it's not like it just changed one day, you know, it's every show we did together, there's been a little more and a little more connection and, you know, we all understand each other better as players.
Excellent. And Ghostlight is going to be touring the West Coast in November. Can you give us a little hint as to what's ahead for 2020 for you and or Ghostlight?
Well, Ghostlight in the beginning of next year, we have Brooklyn Bowl in January. So we'll be back in New York. We're really, really excited to make that show up that we missed last spring.
Right.
And yeah. We're doing Jam Cruise, so we'll be out there.
Excellent. It's like every other year at this point for you. So it seems to
that
be the pattern.
Way. Yeah. I'm really excited. I mean, selfishly, I'm excited for our West Coast tour in the fall.
Yeah.
Being a San Franciscan, I'm excited for us to get back to the West Coast. It's been a minute.
Yes.
And I don't feel like all bands give the West Coast enough love, so I'm happy that we're making the trip.
You're
out
making
there.
The 2 weeks count. In writing that up, I will say that. And of course, you could come to Jam Bass for the details on that. And Holly, really thank you for your time. Wish you all the best moving forward. And I'm excited to see you on Jam Cruise, if not before then.
Yeah, I'll see you there. Thanks for having me on.
Listening to this episode of the Jam Bass Podcast. As noted, Jam Bass is pleased to be a media partner of the Osiris Podcast Network. Episode 48 has been sponsored by Eagle Rock Entertainment, and look for the Magpie Salutes High Water 2 at a music retailer near you or streaming service. Thanks again to Chad for taking part in the rundown, and to Holly for talking setlist with me. This episode and all others are produced by Jake Alexander, whose Clangin' and Bangin' Band provides our theme song. Finally, thanks to you, our listeners. Hit us up at podcast@jambass.com with any comments or questions. And if you could take the time to leave us a comment or a rating on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or whatever podcast provider you use, we'd appreciate it. Until next time, go see live music.